ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. An economic impact assessment on Buffelgrass in the Northern Territory says the costs of Buffelgrass far outweigh the benefits. The NT Cattlemen's Association, though, thinks the report has got it very wrong.
We have serious concerns about the credibility, balance and reliability of this assessment, and that it simply cannot be used.
Also today, you'll hear from a bush tucker company in the Territory, which is celebrating 10 years in business. And at the Agronomy Australia conference in Darwin this week, a special award has been given to Professor Mike Bell, whose agronomy career started nearly 50 years ago in the Ord Irrigation Scheme.
I remember the first load of melons they ever sent to Perth.
Yep.
They didn't have refrigerated cool rooms at the time, and drove to Perth, opened the back of the truck, and the melons flowed out into the delivery area. So it was a pretty tough lesson to learn.
Looking forward and looking back with Professor Mike Bell, the winner of the CM Donald Medal. This is all coming up on today's Country Hour. A busy show. Hope you can stick around. We're broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC. G'day there if you've tuned in via the podcast. An economic impact assessment on Buffelgrass in the Northern Territory has found the cost of having Buffelgrass in the landscape far outweighs any benefits. The report concluded that further expansion of Buffelgrass beyond its current distribution would generate large net economic losses for the Northern Territory. Now, if you missed the Country Hour yesterday, we spoke to one of the report's authors, Kamaljit Sanger from Charles Darwin University.
So there is a huge cost to the society. So if it keeps on expanding, there is a cost for fire management, there is a huge cost for biodiversity loss, and there is a huge cost for loss of tourism opportunities and, of course, cultural assets that are threatened due to buffer spread and increased fire regimes. So when we compare the benefits and the costs, we are losing roughly about more than $6,000 per hectare per year.
So that's Kamaljit Sanger from Charles Darwin University on the program yesterday, saying that Buffelgrass costs far outweigh any benefits. The NT Cattlemen's Association has now had a chance to read this economic impact assessment, and it's not happy. The NTCA says it has serious concerns about the report's methodology, calculations, assumptions, stakeholder balance and quality assurance processes, and says the report should not be relied upon to direct government policy or regulatory decisions. I spoke earlier to the NTCA's Chief Executive, Romy Carey.
We have serious concerns about the credibility, balance and reliability of this assessment. Industry feels extremely strongly that this is not a robust enough assessment to inform government policy or regulatory decision making, and that it simply cannot be used. It's taken a far too narrow lens of the contribution and economic value of buffalo on the pastoral industry, and what it's resulted in is a report that we don't think is comprehensive enough to be utilised for those decisions.
What do you mean by narrow lens?
So it hasn't considered far enough the economic value of Buffelgrass on the pastoral estate and its contribution to the industry's resilience and success. So that economic contribution, this report was commissioned to understand both sides of the equation. We understand that this is a complex issue. And from industry's view, this report simply hasn't gone far enough to quantify the value of Buffelgrass.
Was the NTCA involved in this economic impact assessment?
We did provide submissions and feedback, right, Matt, and those we can see pieces where that has been given consideration throughout the narrative in this economic impact assessment, but we certainly don't feel that our feedback has gone and been considered far enough. And so what we've done now as a next step is requested, and we will meet with CDU to seek clarification and request the data that sits in behind this, because we certainly don't feel as an industry that there has been enough consideration given to the economic value of buffer grass.
Is it simply the cattle industry doesn't like the numbers that show the cost of buffer grass and the impact it's having on the environment?
No, I don't think so. This is not, industry just not agreeing with the numbers. This is very simply a report that's not comprehensive enough. Industry separately, through an MLA process, have got a economic impact assessment being developed through CSIRO. Mm. And the framework that sits behind that is extremely comprehensive, and we will await the findings in that. You know, I think it's not for me to sit here and put a number on that. What we've asked for when we ask for this economic impact assessment, which I think is important to note in this conversation, is this is something that industry did ask for. We asked for a really robust assessment of the value and the contribution and also the impact, and that's not what we can see in this report.
When's that other economic impact assessment due out?
I don't have a final date, but my understanding is it's not too far away.
Okay. And so in the background, you've got a Commonwealth government trying to decide whether or not to turn this grass into a weed of national significance or not. What's your gut feeling on where all this is heading?
I think that buffalo is far too valuable for our industries. This is a species that the cattle industry relies on. It's a species of grass that enables cattle production in really harsh, arid and semi-arid landscapes where there would otherwise not be industry. I think that this report also plays into that national piece, and it's really important that it's not taken out of context in its current form. So, look, our position is really clear on buffalo being declared a weed of national significance. We do not support it.
I see in the NTCA's press release out today, it's got language like the cattle industry supports regional employment, contractors, livestock transport, local businesses. Yep. Our audience would totally understand that, Romy. But yep. I guess all of that happens, say, in the top end and the Barkly where there's no buffalo. Those arguments don't support having buffalo grass, do they?
They really do, Matt. The buffalo grass in these environments are what enables us to have a resilient and thriving cattle industry. We've got one of Australia's largest organic footprints, and that is completely supported by the buffalo grass that has been established in that region that coexists with all of the native species there. So buffalo grass absolutely is what continues to keep that supply chain not just alive and well, but thriving.
That is Romy Carey, who's the Chief Executive of the NT Cattlemen's Association. You can read this economic impact assessment for yourself if you jump online and go to the Department of Environment's website. So that's where you'll find this economic impact assessment on buffalo grass in the Northern Territory, released by the NT government this week. And if you missed our conversation yesterday with one of the report's authors, that's up on our podcast. It's 22 to 1. This is the Country Hour. And up next, we're talking about Bush Tucker with a territory company that is celebrating 10 years of business. What have been its big wins over the years? What have been its big lessons? And what does the next 10 years look like? Shannon Motlop, founder of Aboriginal Community Harvest, who'll be on the program next. Stick around. That's King Stingray right across the territory on the ABC. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Our text number is 0487 991057. Regarding buffalo grass, got a text here from Bruce who says, Matt, on buffalo grass, what a relief to hear government policy has listened to a scientist and acted on it. The cattle industry has got to understand that a weed of national significance affects so many more people, animals and plants than their industry, says Bruce. And another text here, no name attached to it, says, if cows can't live in the desert, then they can't live in the desert. You can't justify planting an invasive grass just to suit yourself. Remember gamba grass. Says someone here on the text. 0487991057 is the number for the Country Hour. Or you can also send a text via the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Raylene Brown and I work in the bush foods industry in Central Australia, working with some amazing ingredients like our beautiful kwandongs, wattle seeds, bush tomatoes. Wow, I love them, their little tangy flavour. And you're listening to the Country Hour.
A bush foods company started by former AFL player Shannon Motlop is celebrating 10 years in business. Since 2016, Shannon and his family have been harvesting bush foods, including green ants and magpie geese, supplying some of Australia's top restaurants and exporting some of their products around the world. Shannon says it's great to see native foods popping up on menus around the nation, and he's keen to see more of it.
It's just gotten a lot more popular, native food across the country. It didn't seem like there were so many people doing it in the early days, and now there's a fair number of people that have shops and harvesting and all sorts of things. So yeah, the word native has become very popular.
When you first started in 2016, did you imagine you'd get to this point?
Because we saw the figures and where the industry was going. So, we definitely saw it being the way it is today. I wouldn't say I've reached my goals in it, and that's for myself and my family as well. We haven't probably reached our goals and where we want to be with it, but we're definitely growing as a business and as a family business.
What are the goals for the business?
I want to be more prominent in communities and creating micro businesses in communities. So that's something I haven't fully achieved to the level that I want to. But also, I guess the big picture of the business, getting to where we want to be there, maybe having some items in Coles and those bigger chain stores and things. So, pushing into those big stores is a little bit harder. So just, I guess we're a bit comfortable where we are.
You touched on setting up micro businesses in communities. What's your dream of that looking like?
I dream of hubs right across the NT. It's been a little bit difficult at the moment. So if there's any communities out there that want to work with us, let us know. We've worked with Bowanunga, the rangers out at Maningrida, the ladies over in Wadai have collected a lot of Kakadu plum for us. But we're really happy to grow that a lot more and have more hubs doing some work for us.
What products sort of over the years have proved to be really popular?
You know, you get your regulars like your kangaroo that people, a lot of people across Australia have tasted kangaroo. I go into schools, most kids have tasted kangaroo. Your basic stuff that you don't think of as native, like your mud crab, your barramundi, all those sorts of bush tuckers, we don't generally think of them as native. But pushing those, the ones that most people haven't tasted, like your magpie goose, wallaby, and lots of exotic meats. Even we've done camel as well. So just getting those to a point where people find them normal and are used to eating them. So that's probably where we want to be.
How do you collect and harvest most of your bush food that you sell?
Yeah, so I head out to properties and around Darwin and harvest green ants, bush apple, kakadu plum, magpie goose, and a few other little ones. And so I harvest that, get it back into town, and box it all up, and I send it down to Something Wild in Adelaide, who package it all up and send it off.
And where are you exporting to at the moment?
Everywhere. So we've exported to Singapore, the US. We've exported our product everywhere. So obviously the green ants are in the green ant gin that we do, and that's a very big product and it's very popular, and that goes across the world as well.
Have you seen an increase in other businesses selling native foods in the 10 years that you've been operating?
No, I guess that's our point. We'd like to see more of the restaurants around Darwin doing native foods. We, as Fire and Forage, we put native food at the front of the menu rather than just a couple of items in the background. So, yeah, that's what Fire and Forage is about. But I would love to see more restaurants using our product.
Where do you see yourself in another 10 years as a business?
Probably doing less of the harvesting. I've got some kids coming through that will have to take over that, I think. I'll be getting a little bit older, but I don't think I want to be doing that. So, yeah, hopefully more on the management side and a good, you know, work staff and people picking up the pieces where I can't do.
That's Shannon Motlop, founder of Aboriginal Community Harvest, which is celebrating 10 years in business. He was speaking there to George Nicol. The text number here at the Country Hour is 0487 991057. I've got a text here from Nina who says, Matt, regarding buffle grass, unfortunately, it doesn't coexist with native species, as Romy Carey said. Buffle is so invasive, it eventually replaces native plants. We've got to find a balance or face extinction of many territory plants and wildlife that depend on them, says Nina. And another message here says, Matt, the NTCA argument shot itself in both feet. How can you argue that the environment can't sustain the cattle industry without buffle grass and then not realise that buffle grass is massively changing that environment? 0487 991057 is the text here at the Country Hour if you want to join the conversation about buffle grass or something else that you'll hear today on the Country Hour.
Hello, Derek Brontatamary here, TV Rangers, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Just quickly to some bird flu news. A Northern Territory politician is calling for COVID-19 style health messaging resources in Indigenous communities to be created in preparation for expected outbreaks of H5 bird flu. Arafura MLA Manuel Brown says he worries that when bird flu does arrive in the territory, there could be a high risk to Indigenous people who regularly hunt magpie geese and ducks. He's calling on both the territory and federal governments to fund videos and information posters warning people not to touch potentially sick or dead birds.
We eat not just ducks and geese, but other species of birds. So that connection between people just touching bird in the remote communities, that information needs to be put out in community, what the effects that could have.
Meanwhile, the Federal Ag Minister, Julie Collins, says following yesterday's National Cabinet meeting, the Commonwealth has agreed to invest an extra $125 million to support emergency biosecurity response activities for H5 bird flu as case numbers continue to grow.
Across the country, the latest figures indicate there have been 330 positive events. There have been over 29,000 calls to our national hotline. In South Australia, we currently have 195 events. In Victoria, 100. New South Wales, 13. Tasmania, 10. Western Australia, 10. And Queensland has 2. With the spread of the H5 bird flu across the country, our government is doing everything we can to help protect Australia's wildlife wherever possible, to protect our agricultural industries wherever possible, our communities and our economy from the effects of the H5 bird flu. That's why, following National Cabinet, our government has committed further funding to continue safeguarding the country against the impacts of the H5 bird flu. This will bring our government's total investment in terms of the bird flu response to more than $270 million. The additional $125 million will be made available from the Commonwealth to support immediate actions through the National Emergency Biosecurity Response for the H5 bird flu. These activities will include vital surveillance, early detection, on-ground response capability, targeted initiatives for priority threatened species and conservation, as well as local community engagement.
That is the Federal Ag Minister, Julie Collins. Bird flu found in every single Australian state, but thankfully still not in the Northern Territory. It's 8 to 1. This is the Country Hour. Matt Brown with you this afternoon. Up next, let's talk about gas, because gas from the Beetaloo Basin in the next few days will be piped north to Channel Island. Beetaloo Gas will start powering homes and businesses in the Top End. And as of yesterday, sounds like that gas has also got the all clear to power data centres.
This week on Landline, the Simpson Desert Park Ranger retiring after 30 years.
I'm so proud of the uniform and what it represents to Queensland. It's the ultimate for me. Get the job with the National Parks has given me the freedom to talk about my cultural heritage, to talk about my people in the desert.
That's Landline Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
The Territory's Chief Minister, Leah Finocchiaro, says the first gas from the Beetaloo Basin will start powering NT businesses and homes within the next few days.
In the Territory, we have an incredibly unique situation where in less than 7 days' time, the Beetaloo Basin will be powering Territory homes and businesses. And there is enough gas in that reservation to power our entire nation for 200 years, plus support our allies and the region.
So there you go, Beetaloo Gas. Next week, we'll start travelling up the Amadeus Pipeline to Channel Island to help power homes and businesses in the Top End. And in the future, it could also be used to power data centres. At National Cabinet just yesterday, the NT received, I guess, an exemption of sorts from the Commonwealth's proposal to make data centres be powered by new renewable energy projects. Looks like the other states will use renewable energy and the Territory is going to put the foot on the gas. So data centres in the NT, they can use gas, which the NT's Energy Minister, Gerard Maley, has welcomed.
This is a good move for the Territory. We know that we've got the Beetaloo gas, which is coming out of the ground and will be powering our electricity in the Northern Territory as of next week. So that means when you turn the lights on or turn your air conditioner on, Beetaloo gas will be running the electricity to do that, allow Territorians to have a better life. So, and the data centres is another way we can use that Beetaloo gas and make benefit for Territorians and the people who live here to get jobs in the Territory.
People who have driven into the city in Darwin over recent days would see the advertising that I'm not sure who's paid for at your department, another flagging that literally on a flag that the Beetaloo is coming online next week. Who will be Beetaloo's, the first customers who access gas from the Beetaloo?
The first customers will be coming into Territory Generation and powering, running our generators out on Channel Island. That gas is going to come up the Armadale's pipeline and go into which you already get gas from Alice Springs. And remember, Blacktip from over near Port Keep had an issue and there's zero gas out of that, which has been forcing us to buy spot gas for a recent period. So this gas is going to come up, run our generators, which will run in Katherine and Darwin, and also can go south if it needs to be. But the first gas will be coming up here, helping us put on our lights, turn your air conditioner on, charge your electric vehicles. All that stuff is going to be from the result of Beetaloo gas.
Right. So Territorians are the first customers. You obviously want there to be more customers, specifically on the East Coast and other parts of the world as well. You can't do that without a good pipeline. Have you had any progress or any updates about a pipeline between the Northern Territory and the East Coast to get Beetaloo gas from here to there?
There has been discussions. I know APA and other pipeline installers have been doing their own work in relation to that. But what we've been doing here as a government is the Energy Link, which is a corridor, 130-metre wide corridor from the Beetaloo to Darwin, getting all the approvals done, clearing the native title, getting that ready to be able to put that pipeline, because we want to focus on getting the gas up here to the Territory, running our generators to make sure the Territorians benefit first. Then once we get that running and sorted out, we can sell the gas to the East Coast. Remember, we are talking an enormous amount of gas. The estimate is that there's enough gas in the Beetaloo to power all of Australia for 200 years. So clearly we're not going to use that gas ourselves, but we want to make sure the Territory gets its first gas, and then after that we can sell the gas off to the Eastern Seaboard. We know that there's a gas shortage coming on the Eastern Seaboard. They're talking about importing gas from overseas, which just sounds absolutely ridiculous to me. We've got a great resource here. We want to get it into the Northern Territory first. We want to make sure our energy policy, which is cheap, reliable and affordable gas, is number one priority for us. And then after that, we'd be able to sell the gas off to the Eastern Seaboard, because remember, Laura, we get the royalties out of this. And as well as that, the traditional owners and the native title have done agreements in relation to these proponents to get native title rights, and they have their own royalties as well. So this is going to be a win-win for Territorians right across the board.
That's the Territory's Energy Minister, Gerard Maley, speaking earlier to Lara Stimson. The NT Resources Week Conference, it starts Wednesday next week. I'd put money on that first gas from the Beetaloo arriving on that day. We'll see, but I reckon that just may line up. Still on gas, Beetaloo Digital, which is a subsidiary of Beetaloo Energy. It's, as you probably know, it's working towards building a data centre out at Waddell in Darwin's rural area. It wants to use Beetaloo gas to power that data centre, and it has made some steps towards the pipeline that is required to make this happen. I'm joined in the studio by Tom Robinson. What's the latest, Tom?
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, Beetaloo Digital has told the ASX that it's signed a deal with a company called Australian Gas Infrastructure Group, which owns and operates gas pipelines around Australia. They're going to start planning a gas pipeline from the Beetaloo to the site in Waddell that has been set aside for that data centre. So that'd be a 750-kilometre long gas pipeline to the 185-hectare site that was set aside by the Territory Government for a big hyperscale data centre in Darwin's rural area. This pipeline would go through the Territory Energy Link, which is the Northern Territory Government's proposed Territory Energy Link, which is the same infrastructure corridor which will be used to bring gas from the Beetaloo to Darwin. Heard Gerard Maley just talking about that.
Okay, there's a bit going on.
Fair bit.
Charles Vaughan here, Australian Cattle Enterprises and Charles Vaughan Veterinary Services. I'm here today at Berrimer Export Yards, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, you'll hear from a fashion designer who is looking to blend northern cotton with recycled fire service uniforms. You'll hear about this project in a moment. And at the Agronomy Australia conference that's on in Darwin this week, a special award has been given to Professor Mike Bell, whose agronomy career started nearly 50 years ago out near the WA-NT border.
I remember the first load of melons they ever sent to Perth.
Yep.
They didn't have refrigerated cool rooms at the time, and drove to Perth, opened the back of the truck, and the melons flowed out into the delivery area. So it was a pretty tough lesson to learn.
50 years, nearly 50 years of being an agronomist, helping the agricultural sector. He's got some stories to share with you this afternoon, Professor Mike Bell. And we're hearing from you this afternoon on the text line regarding Beetaloo gas set to be piped up to the top end in the coming days. Someone here in the text says, Matt, the energy minister's claim about powering all of Australia for 200 years, can someone please fact check that one for me? And another message that says, getting royalties is not enough. The gas companies have basically been given this gas for free. Market says we'll sell the gas to the Eastern Seaboard. It's nonsense. The gas companies will be selling this gas and make a profit for themselves, not for Territorians. Tax them more. Maybe that money can go into some much-needed new hospitals, says someone here on the text line this afternoon. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Rebecca Patrick's there this afternoon. Much to report weather-wise today, Beck.
Sunny skies throughout much of the Territory at the moment. So, yeah, not too much going on. A little bit of wind through the central districts. Got a ridge through the Northern Territory at the moment, and that's going to be persisting right through the next week, really. That Barkley breeze continuing through the next week. Also seeing a bit of wind around the northern and eastern coastal areas of the top end. That's about it.
How strong are the winds at the moment?
In Tennant Creek, we've seen gusts getting up to, let me just check that, about 40 kilometres per hour gusts. So, yeah, a little bit blowy through there. Mm-hmm. And around the top end coast, so we've got Centre Island, pretty windy at the moment, 25 knots, so close to strong winds through the Gulf of Carpentaria for those out in boats. And, yeah, it's pretty fresh winds across the Arafura Sea as well.
There's no warnings, there's no fire bans. How long are you expecting that to last?
Yeah, so we do have high fire danger in the Darwin-Adelaide River area due to drier conditions that have moved up with those southeasterlies over the last couple of days. But, yeah, no warnings or fire bans at the moment. Those winds dropping off a fraction compared to yesterday. And it will be fairly similar for the next few days. So a little bit of wind, warmer than average temperatures and slightly reduced humidity for the next few days across the top end.
Easy going. Thanks so much for your time, Beck. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
It's Jessie Longmuir here from Land for Wildlife, and we are at Pitchy Ritchie Heritage Sanctuary. We are out here surveying different insects, different mammals, different reptiles, and we're having a great time. Thanks for listening to the Country Hour on ABC.
It's 1:10. A fashion designer is breathing new life into old fire service uniforms that would normally be destined for landfill. Lisa Piller is working on a project to get old uniforms and blend them with fresh cotton from the Kimberley's new cotton gin at Kununurra. She had a chat to Jess Baker about this new blend that she's working on.
So Project Recover begins with retired Parks and Wildlife Fire Service uniforms. These uniforms have spent years in the service and stewardship of Western Australia's forests, parks and wildlife. But at the end of their life, commonly with these kinds of uniforms and other post-consumer textiles, they're discarded. They end up in landfill because we don't yet have sustainable solutions for their afterlife. And so the Recover Project was about me asking a question really about the afterlife of these uniforms and uniforms more broadly. What if we could reimagine them? What if instead of being discarded and ending up in landfill, we can utilise these materials to become the beginning of a new and West Australian focused textile and fashion story?
So the project begins with old Parks and Wildlife uniforms and then those are transformed back into fibre. How does that work?
So I was really fortunate in this project to work with ThredUp Australia. ThredUp Australia developed a custom-built fibre opening technology right out of Canning Vale down near Perth. And they partnered with Parks and Wildlife to recycle that legacy fire service uniforms back into fibre. And so it's a mechanical recycling process where it gently shreds the post-consumer textiles in a way that opens the fibres and retains the length of them so that they can be reused and respun back into yarn.
This is where Kimberley cotton comes into the mix. So what's the benefit of blending that material with Kimberley cotton?
Yeah, so the problem with mechanically recycled textiles and the fibre that results from them is that it tends to be shorter than virgin fibres. It's often been worn a lot. I mean, particularly in the case of uniforms, they're worn and laundered a lot and some of them are aged items. So the fibre just doesn't have the integrity that a new virgin fibre would have. And so to give the yarn the strength that's required for taking it through to the next processes like knitting and weaving, we need to blend that recovered fibre with a virgin fibre. So for my project, I really wanted to tell a story about regenerative and sustainable textile practices. And with the emerging cotton industry in the Kimberley that's been sort of accelerated by the fantastic new gin up there, I really wanted to work with Kimberley cotton as the virgin fibre to blend with that recovered fibre from the Parks and Wildlife Fire Service uniforms and to, you know, create create that yarn that told that story of two really distinct West Australian materials, you know, that create a really unique WA fibre blend.
So what do you plan to do with the blended yarn?
So the blended yarn took a couple of months to work out the best way to process it, blend it, card it, and then get it into a form that it could be spun. And I worked alongside researchers at Deakin University's ARC Research Hub for Future Fibres to assist me in that. And the cotton spinning mill that operates out of their research facility is really quite extraordinary. And with the resulting yarn that came from that process, I'm now working with two knitwear manufacturers. I'm trying to produce a series of prototypes, so a couple of fashion pieces, a couple of more corporate style V-neck sweaters, with the idea that wouldn't it be amazing if we could take those uniforms as our source material, but then be able to reimagine them as a new uniform that's working with that recovered material.
Would that be a new uniform for Parks and Wildlife staff?
I think at this stage it's all very conceptual and proof of concept, and whether we can achieve what we're trying to achieve feasibly. But certainly that's kind of the intent, whether it's for Parks and Wildlife or whether it's a concept where it could be applied to another organisation or another pathway.
That's Lisa Piller, who is a fashion designer and PhD candidate with RMIT University's School of Fashion and Textiles.
You'll find barrow loads of gardening goodness in the September issue of Gardening Australia. Explore the best plants for long-lasting blooms, visit a native garden, and tour a tropical backyard. There's expert help for your roses and indoor plants, advice on replenishing your soil, plus tips on growing passion fruit, water chestnut, and spring veg. Gardening Australia, from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
Agronomy Australia has awarded Professor Mike Bell the prestigious C.M. Donald Medal, recognising nearly 50 years of fantastic work and leadership in Australian agronomy. Currently working for the University of Queensland, Professor Bell's agronomy career started in the Kimberley's Ord Irrigation Scheme back in 1979. I caught up with Mike to get his thoughts on the future of agronomy, but also hear a few yarns about those early years in the far north.
Yeah, g'day, Matt. Mike Bell. I'm the Professor of Agronomy at University of Queensland in Gatton, and I've been working in agronomy for nearly 50 years now, so thoroughly enjoyed my whole career.
And your career started in the Ord Irrigation Scheme in the Kimberley. Can you tell me the story of how a kid from Queensland, ended up in the Ord in the late 70s.
Yeah, a very raw kid from Queensland, I can tell you. I was looking for something to do when I graduated, and there was a part-time job opportunity with CSIRO as a casual for 6 to 8 months. I thought, I've never seen that part of Australia, so off we went. And towards the end of that work, which I thoroughly enjoyed, the West Australian department had an agronomist vacancy. They'd made a job offer eventually, and the bloke had gone off, and interestingly, to be a rural reporter with the ABC in that time, and so they wanted someone for the wet season. And I happened to play tennis with a lot of those blokes, and they said, are you looking for a job by any chance?
And there you were.
There I was. And so timing is everything in some of these instances. And I stayed for 5 years, and we did a lot of work on peanuts in particular on the sandy soils.
Yeah, well, tell us more about that, because this is really still early days for the town of Kununurra, early days for the Ord Irrigation Scheme. So as an agronomist, what were the problems you were trying to solve?
Wow. This was post-cotton. So cotton had just fallen over recently. There was all the pesticide issues and everything else that were going on, the bulletproof bugs that were had been hammering it, and we were looking for alternative options. And the sandy soils around the irrigation area were targeted for development, and peanuts were touted as a possibility. I'd had a predecessor in that role, Dr. Roland Lawrence, who'd started to do some of the early work. And I came in 1979, late 79, and just at the time when we were getting the research up and running properly and a commercial peanut farm was in the development. I think the first crops were probably in 1981 wet season with Jim Hughes, who was the, I think he was chairman of the Ord Co-op at the
yes,
time.
Yes, yep.
And we had...
Cunanara still has the Jim Hughes Amphitheatre there on the banks of the Ord River. Yes.
Okay, yeah, no, Jim was a tremendous guy to work with and real dynamo. And then there are a few other guys developed. So all that sandy soil out past where the old rice gin used to be. But as you head out of town, out into the main irrigation area...
Yeah, sort of on land, my understanding is on land where the sugar mill decades later was built.
Yes, yeah.
And there's actually a cotton gin now.
Yes. Well, the pilot farm for the sugar industry was starting up while we were there, so the early 1980s. Rocky Lurch was the manager, I remember that. But when the peanuts were going well, PWD ran the peanut mill, or the shelling plant at the time, and in the end they handed that over to the co-op to run. But at the same time, we were struggling to find crops to grow with peanuts. Peanuts were extremely successful.
Right.
But what else do you grow with them? You can't grow peanuts.
So finding that rotational crop.
Crop, that was viable. You know, we could grow maize, we could grow other things, but taking maize from the Cullinara in those days to somewhere else was a big deal and just cost prohibitive. So at the same time, the veggie melon production was just starting up and they were targeting the sands as well. And so we ended up with this, you couldn't grow peanuts, the melons were grown in the dry season, but peanuts were a terrible weed for a melon producer because they couldn't kill them. So peanuts are pretty tough to kill when you don't want them to grow. You can kill them very easily when you do want them to grow. But,
yeah.
And so I think that was the beginning of the death knell of peanuts up there, is that the hoardy operations were much more profitable, particularly once they got the cool rooms and refrigerated transport and everything else all sorted out. I remember the first load of melons they ever sent to Perth.
Yep.
They didn't have refrigerated cool rooms at the time, and so that, you know, they loaded the trucks, put the tarps on, drove to Perth, opened the back of the truck, and the melons flowed out into the delivery area. So it was a pretty tough lesson to learn, but cool rooms came in pretty quickly after that to try and get the temperature down before you put the tarp on the top. So.
Wow. You went on to do lots of work with peanuts in Queensland.
Yeah.
And certainly there was a big crack at doing peanuts in Katherine back in the day. Does it surprise you that peanuts have well and truly gone off the agenda in this part of northern Australia?
Oh, I think it's a really sad story that peanuts have sort of gone off the agenda everywhere. I mean, Australian has always or had always exported high quality peanuts to the world. We got really premium prices for the product, but now with the collapse of the main peanut processor in Kingaroy, I think the operations in North Queensland, Atherton and Tableland have sort of wound back a fair bit. It's just the Katherine operation was the same. I visited there and Douglas Daly at various times to have a look at what was going on. And just the logistics of getting what is a fairly bulky commodity in the shell to a shelling plant to actually shell them and then transport them to somewhere where they're going to be processed. It was the freight, I think, that knocked them around more than anything else. And if they get too dry, of course, when you shell them, they fall apart. So, you know, you treat them with kid gloves, if you like, in this environment, because when we were growing them in the wet season, and that post-wet period, still pretty warm and low humidities, and so the moisture in the kernels drops really quickly. So when you shell them, you tend to have a lot of splits, which are lower value. It's a real shame. I still eat a lot of peanuts, of course, as a good peanut agronomist would. And I opened a packet of Nobby's nuts the other day, and you see on the slide side that was predominantly from imported peanuts. And you go, that shouldn't happen.
Have you been back to the Ord in recent times?
I have.
Okay, yep.
We left the Ord in 83, and the first time I went back was to do some work with Jack Daniel and the NACRA guys in Mays about 2 years ago.
Right.
And yep. I just thought, wow, you sort of wander around and you look for the old landmarks and things have changed, but a lot of things have still remained the same too. The agricultural development has been tremendous. You know, you see the expansion of areas and everything compared to when we were there. And that's really gratifying to see. It's great to see, things going ahead and the cotton industry there now kicking goals and doing some tremendous stuff.
If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and I'm speaking to Mike Bell at the Agronomy Australia Conference, which has been held this week in Darwin. And as part of this conference, Mike, you received the C.M. Donald Medal.
Yes.
Now, can you explain to us the award and what it means to you?
It was very humbling. The Donald Medal is an institution in the Agronomy Society and acknowledges C.M. Donald, who was, I'm old, but I'm not quite old enough to have known him in his heyday. But it acknowledges, long-term contribution to the agronomy discipline and to agriculture over a career. And it's very humbling to be considered as a recipient for that. So when I was given the nod and told, you've got to prepare talks and we want you to talk about your career, you go, wow, how do I talk about the last 45 years in 45 minutes? But it turned out to be fairly easy.
It was a great presentation.
Yes, well, you can always talk about some of the successes, you also talk about some of the failures, and I tried to do that yesterday, to say that not everything turns out the way you'd hoped, and I guess as long as you learn from it and move on, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
You finish your presentation talking about the future of agronomy.
Yep.
So I wanted to ask you what you think the future is for young agronomists who are coming into a workforce and a world where artificial intelligence is on the rise.
To me, this is one of the biggest challenges for agronomy. I see our role as integrating specialists from all sorts of different spheres to understand how agriculture and farming systems work. And to me, that's the future role of agronomists. The agronomist has to be someone who ground truths all this information that's coming from AI, that's coming from robotic equipment, that's coming from remote sensing, and make sense of it and say, how do I use this knowledge to convert that into a management response for a farmer or an industry? And that requires experience. It requires time. You need to see different things. I mean, you can have all the basic science underpinning it, but when you see that science, you expect something to happen and something else happens for a very valid biological reason. Yeah. But once you start to see those things often enough, you start to appreciate the complexity of what we're trying to manage. And to me, that's the role of agronomists, is to be those integrators, to be those ones who look at recommendations that are coming out from IT systems or AI processes and say, does this make sense? When I convert that back to the soils I'm working in, the environment I'm working in, what I'm trying to do with my cropping system, does this make sense? And to me, one of the big challenges we've got is there's so much information out there, but the context of how that work was done and why things happened doesn't always come with the information. So, you know, and I really feel for some young agronomists who are put into a regional area with an iPad and a mobile phone and say, you know, go to it. You've got guys with big operations buying millions of dollars worth of inputs to put into a system, and you're advising them, and where do you pull your information from? You can find info on the web and everything else, but unless you know how to fact check that, how to contextualise that for the environment, it's very difficult.
So my final question to you, Mike, I'll take us back to Kununurra. What was your biggest barramundi?
Oh, the embarrassing thing was my wife caught a bigger barramundi than I did. So. That's a very funny story there, because when I saw this her pull in this great big monster, I had its head off and its tail off, and I was trying to make it as small as I could for the photographs. Oh, but no, the fishing hooks came out, and she tacked it back together again for the photo. So yeah, I'm humiliated there.
Well done on the award, the Donald Medal, and thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, a big thanks to Professor Mike Bell from the University of Queensland. I was catching up with him at the Agronomy Australia Conference that's been held in Darwin this week. On the text line, Mark says, Matt, I used to load melons by hand onto straw into flat tops and then tarp with a little opening to allow some airflow. We were loading melons out of Garby Blocker's place, Both Camp, there in Kununurra back in the day. I know that farm. And I've got a text here from Bruce who says, Matt, what went down between the Prime Minister's firm announcement 2 days ago that all data centres built in Australia must use 100% renewables to going, yeah, all right, Queensland and the NT can go and use fossil fuels? Bruce says, all of the science I have followed for the last 40 to 50 years has warned us with increasing urgency that if we continue to burn fossil fuels, we will cause catastrophic, possibly irreversible conditions. We now see the highest ocean temperatures ever known. Let's just name the elephant in the room. The gas industry appears to own the Australian government. And as for the CLP, who knows? Perhaps the magnetic poles could flip this wet season, says Bruce, who says he's feeling flabbergasted. That's it for today's Country Hour. We've covered a bit of ground today. If you've missed any of it, you can catch it via our podcast. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon and keep it rural.